To try to fill you in on where we've got to in the last 10 or 15 years in devising tests, devising and executing tests of the validity of quantum mechanics as we go up from the micro to the macro level, and what the significance of the tests which have been done is, and where we might go, try to go from here. But let me start off just reminding you of very briefly of some of the considerations I advanced last time. The motivation is that at a micro level, when we have a superposition of amplitudes for two classically inconsistent patterns of behaviour, then it's rather clearly not equivalent to a classical mixture in which you've simply got one or the other thing happening with a certain probability. And the evidence for that, of course, is the standard interference phenomenon, as we discussed last time. At the macro level, well, the formal superposition of amplitudes would suggest that we indeed have a, not of course a quantum superposition of states of the cat, because the cat is not described by a pure state wave function, but we do, prima facie, have a quantum superposition of states of the universe, in one of which the cat is alive and the other one of which she's dead. On the other hand, we, most of us don't like to think of it that way. We'd much rather try to think in macro-realistic terms, that is, like to think that each particular cat is definitely either dead or alive, independently whether we're observing her or not. And I tried to emphasise in the last lecture that an argument which is very standard in the literature, that somehow decoherence manages to reduce description A to description B, is actually, in my opinion at least, grossly fallacious. So if we are going to tell which of these descriptions at the macro level is correct, if we're going to get description B correct, then it has to be something else. Yes, you had a question. It's a vague word, yes. As you'll see, the examples I'll be talking about are not exactly at the everyday level, but they're at least at much higher level than Tom. So if we're going to have B, then it had better be the result of something, some effects or some considerations which can't come from outside quantum mechanics itself. Something like, for example, the so-called GRWP theory or something similar. I'll call scenarios which lead to scenario B, macro-realistic ones. The question is then, can we tell whether it's A or B which is correct at something which you could reasonably call the macroscopic or at least mesoscopic level? And the answer we said yesterday, last time, was yes, if and only if these two descriptions actually give rise to different experimental predictions. However, if decoherence always implies that by the time we get up to the level in question we have no interference, then the predictions of A and B will be identical. So this better not be the case. We'd better look for quantum interference of macroscopically distinct states. And then I discuss briefly what we mean by macroscopically distinct, and this is a question, of course, we're going to have to come back to in some sense. And my two figures of merit, as it were first of all the extensive difference, that is the difference in some extensive quantity between the two states, measured in some kind of natural atomic units. We'll give some examples of that later. The second figure of merit was what I call the disconnectivity, which, crudely speaking, means the number of particles which are behaving appreciably differently in the two branches. Again, that's not an entirely clear concept. We're going to have to come back to that in a bit more detail. So initially, at least when we're trying to carry out this program, more modest goal would be to find a system which has some prospect of looking for, showing QIMDS, and try to interpret the raw data in terms of quantum mechanics, and then see whether it's A or B which is correct. So now in a moment we'll see some examples of that. However, before I get on to specific examples, I do want to just spend a moment or two addressing one rather generic point. As I think I mentioned previously, when a few of us started talking about the possibility of a program of this type, way back around 1980, we were not at all in the majority. We got a lot of objections from the professional quantum measurement community, who said this is never going to work. You're out of your minds. So you don't even bother to try the experiment. And the reason they basically said this was that they simply been taken for granted for something like 50 years in the quantum measurement literature, that by the time you got to any kind of scale which could even, by a remote stretch of the imagination, be called macroscopic, that is, whenever the two states who you're trying to superpose were macroscopically distinct, then decoherence was always going to come in and kill you stone dead. So now, as we'll see, these experiments were nevertheless successful. So what had gone wrong? Why had so much of the quantum measurement literature severely overestimated the effects of decoherence? I think this is quite an important question in its own right. It's a rather generic one. In the quantum measurement literature, a very common argument you got is is what I call the electron on Sirius argument. And crudely speaking, it goes something like this. It says, suppose you're talking about a macroscopic body, then we can say it's composed of, a large number n of elementary particles. Then you have a fairly generic argument about the splitting or the difference between the energy levels of such a system, and people argued that, crudely speaking, the energy difference between individual many body states was something like some constant A to the minus n, or maybe minus n to the half or minus 2n. It doesn't really matter for this purpose. Therefore, this energy splitting would go to zero exponentially within, and if n is 10 to the 23, say, then exponential minus 10 to the 23 is obviously a very, very small number indeed. And therefore, they argued, this energy difference is so incredibly tiny that even the interaction of the system with an electron on a distant star, for example Sirius, is going to be larger than that. And therefore, by an entirely clear step in the argument, they argued that therefore this interaction with even the most trivial distant object and so forth is going to totally screw up the phase relations between different levels. Therefore, you will never see any kind of interference behavior. There are several reasons, actually, why that argument is wrong. The first is that, in fact, if you actually start thinking about the coupling of any specific system to its environment, and the environment in this case would include the electron on Sirius and whatever, then it turns out that, in fact, most of the matrix elements between the many-body states are just zero. If they're only very specific variables of your many-body system, characteristically macroscopic or semi-macroscopic variables, which couple to the environment. So, in fact, you should not be thinking about the energy differences. If you're going to think about energy differences, you should not think about the differences between the individual many-body levels, but only between a certain class of them. So that's one reason why that, I think, people make gross overestimates of the effect of decoherence. However, I think the second reason is more interesting. It has to do with the phenomenon of what I call adiabatic decoherence. In the literature, you'll sometimes find it called false decoherence. And let's just illustrate what I mean by that by taking a specific model. Suppose we have a standard spin boson model. So you have a spin-a-half system, a two-state system, which is coupled to a bath of oscillators. So your Hamiltonian, you have a Hamiltonian for the system, which is simply this standard standard two-state Hamiltonian. In the case of a spin, it would correspond to a magnetic field along the x-axis, but it's much more generic than that. We have an environment which we'll just model as a set of simple harmonic oscillators, but it's crucial to this argument that the lower frequency cutoff on your oscillators is large compared to delta, the intrinsic two-state splitting. And finally, you have a standard form of the system-environment interaction, which is, so you have an interaction which is linear with the oscillator coordinates and proportional to sigma z, so it does not commute then with the Hamiltonian of the system. Now, it turns out that in this limit, that the minimum oscillator frequency is much greater than delta, you can actually get a pretty good approximate solution to behavior of the system. Suppose that at time zero, I coerce the system into a state where sigma z, say, equals plus one. So it's in the language of a two-well system, it corresponds to, say, setting the system in the left-hand well. Okay? So that's an eigenstate of sigma z. That will then, we can then ask, how does the oscillator bath relax to that? And the answer is, well, the oscillator will just shift across so as to minimize the original Hamiltonian plus this this term here. Just get the standard Frank-Condon kind of shift here. Now, imagine that at time zero, having initialized the system and the bath in this state, we now relax the constraint and allow the full Hamiltonian, including this delta sigma x term, to take effect. Well, what happens? What happens is that the system does indeed try to tunnel between the two wells. However, as it does so, it's highly constrained by the environment. It has to, in some sense, drag the environment with it, the oscillators with it. So this results in the fact that the actual matrix element, the effective matrix element for tunneling, is renormalized downwards very strongly. The standard in, say, molecular physics, this is just the Frank-Condon effect, a very familiar phenomenon. So suppose the matrix element will still be finite, be non-zero. So imagine that we wait until a time which is in the order of h-bar divided by the renormalized tunneling frequency. If we choose the numerical factor here appropriately, then what we'll find is that the wave function of the universe after this time is in fact a coherent quantum superposition of a state in which the oscillator is in the left, the system is in the left well and the oscillators have adjusted to that, plus a state in which the oscillator is in the right well and the oscillators have adjusted to that. And the crucial point now is that the overlap between the two oscillator wave functions is the standard Frank-Condon form, exponential minus f, where f is a quantity which involves the various coupling constants, etc., etc. And by choosing these coupling constants appropriately, we can make this very small indeed. So now let's ask ourselves, what is the reduced density matrix of the system at this time?
Sorry, you can make f small or e to the minus f small?
We will make e to the minus f small. Yep. So f will be large. Yep, thank you. What's the reduced density matrix of the system? In the approximation that we just take this equal to zero, then the density matrix of the system is quite boring. It's just a diagonal with half matrix elements of half here. And strictly speaking, of course, we should put not zero, but e to the minus f in here. Now, if you follow a very substantial portion of the quantum measurement literature, you will find that you're told that once the system density matrix has taken this kind of form with essentially zero off-diagonal matrix elements, then you've effectively completely decoherent. No subsequent interference effects are possible. This is clearly completely wrong in this case. Because what's going to happen? If I now, you see, I've got this coherent superposition of these two states. If I now let the system run for another time, which is, clearly speaking, the same as this, then what I'll find is that everything ends up in this state here. Okay. In other words, what I've got effectively now is a two-state system in this higher Hilbert space, if you like. So I've started from state one. I've gone through the quantum superposition of states 1 and 2. There probably ought to be an I sitting in front of here, I think, but I've ignored that. And eventually, I'm going to oscillate across to the other state in that system. Is that argument clear?
I don't see why it's going to get that kind of a recurrence unless you have a very special relationship between the coupling coefficients.
Well, the only special relationship you have is this one here. So all I'm saying, you see, is that, as I say, you can basically, given this approximation here, you can basically truncate the whole of the relevant part of your Hilbert space
into a sort of magnified two-state system in which the oscillators always adiabatically address the system. So if you leave it long enough, you're going to get a 0, 0, 0, 1 here. In other words, you're going to get complete re-interference, as it were, of these two components. So this is actually a very, very, very common kind of situation in everyday life in physics. That is, you very often have a system which is interacting really quite strongly with its environment, so that if you calculate the reduced density matrix of the system at a particular time, you're likely to find it's very close to diagonal, therefore boring. Nevertheless, you still get interference. Example, it's not a terribly good example because you have to figure out the exact coupling constants and so forth, but think about a neutron interferometer. We're all used to the idea that you take a neutron, you split the beam into two parts, they diverge by maybe 30 centimetres, something like that. You then recombine them, and lo and behold, you get a beautiful interference pattern. Now, you should be puzzled by that. Why? Because, you know, all the textbooks will tell you, well, we just write down a wave function for the neutron, and we just propagate it, and lo and behold, everything comes out. Is that really right? No, it's not. Because, after all, that neutron has a magnetic moment. The magnetic moment interacts with the blackbody radiation field. So as the neutron goes through the interferometer, the radiation field is reacting differentially to whether the neutron is going this way or this way. Now, of course, to see exactly how serious that interference effect is, you need to know about the coupling constants and cutoffs and so forth. But the point is that we know for sure that the 100% contrast is not reduced by this effect. Why not? Well, the way of expressing it in words is that, sure, as the two beams, as it were, or the two parts of the neutron wave function diverge, then the environment reacts differentially to them. However, as they reconverge, the environment just comes back in again. So by the time you've got to the point where the beams re-interfere, the environment is just back in its original state. Okay? So, so this is a very, very common situation all over physics. I mean, it's so common that we don't even bother to comment very often. But in the context of these arguments about decoherence in macroscopic bodies, it really is rather important to appreciate that. Okay, is that point, did I get that point across? Because it is, I think, yes.
About this argument based on exponentially small energy gap. So it doesn't forbid a superposition between the degenerate states. So, I mean, even if you believe in this argument, it still doesn't forbid superposition of two states with the same energy.
I mean, I think if you follow this argument and believe that chi plus and chi minus,
so I'm
taking
on the original argument.
I see. Fair enough. But then I think people, if I try to think back myself back into the mindset of the people who wrote these articles, I think they would argue that the probability of getting exactly zero energy splitting is negligibly small in a macroscopic body from rather general considerations.
And so,
I mean, frankly, I'm not the person to defend these arguments because, as you say, I don't believe them. I think that's what they say. Okay, good. So now let's turn to the nitty-gritty, specific systems which have been used in this attempt to search for quantum interference of macroscopically distinct states. QIMD is quantum interference of macroscopically distinct states. The most sort of literal extrapolation of the experiments which we all know and love at the single particle level, namely Young-Slitz experiments and so forth, is the work of the Vienna group, Anton Zeilinger and company. Nowadays the leader of this particular effort is Marcus Arndt, and if you want references for that, they're here. And this really is just a Young-Slitz experiment of the classical type. So you have a source here. You have particles emerging from the source, passing through two slits, and forming, hopefully, some kind of interference pattern on a final screen here. The What's new about this experiment is that what's coming out of the source now is not single photons or single electrons or even hydrogen molecules. Incidentally, who knows when the first interference experiment using hydrogen molecules was done? Anyone like to take a guess? It's actually 1928, if you don't know what. So molecular diffraction, as in the literal sense, is not a new thing. However, of course, what is a new, very new thing here is that the molecules in question are now not H2, they're something like C60, right? Fullerene molecules. Well, really rather highly complex beasts with lots and lots of internal degrees of freedom and so forth. They didn't bother to monochromate or even strongly to collimate the beam. The beam which came out of the oven had this the standard form. This is something you'll find in standard textbooks on molecular dynamics. And you might think at first sight that this was just too diffuse a beam to show any kind of interference effects. But no, it turns out you can still see a reasonable interference effect. Okay, this is not as good as you get with photons or electrons, obviously, but you can see the dips. And it's pretty good. I think most people are convinced that that really is real interference here. The second point about this experiment, I think a very amusing point, is, well, what about so-called which way effects? You remember that if we, there's a sort of standard piece of law which is quoted in most discussions of the Young-Slitz experiment. If we can actually look to see which of these two paths is followed, then we should not be able to see any interference. Okay? Can we in fact look to see in this case? The oven is at something like 900 to 1,000 degrees Kelvin. And lots and lots of vibrational modes of the internal modes of the molecules are going to be excited. Now, you could argue most of those are perhaps irrelevant because they decouple from everything else in sight, and that's generally true. But it turns out there are four modes of the fullerene molecule, the C60, which are actually infrared active, which means that as the molecules pass through this device, each of these modes will absorb or emit several quanta of radiation. Now, why? The question is, why doesn't that destroy interference? Anyone like to take a shot at the answer? Okay. Well, yes. Well, the answer is that, it's rather neat. If you actually figure out the frequencies of these modes and therefore the frequency and wavelength of the modes of the infrared radiation field which they emit, it turns out to be large compared to the spacing here. So you're not, in fact, so when the molecule emits or absorbs a quantum of electromagnetic radiation, it does not count as a which way measurement. And in fact, these were the original experiments. In a later run, a couple of years later, the same group redid the experiment with a somewhat hotter oven temperature, but more importantly, a larger spacing between the slits. And they, sure enough, they found the interference effects progressively went away as they did that. This is all really very nice, I think. It does illustrate some of the fundamental concepts of the quantum theory of measurement and so forth. But for sure, it does seem like you are seeing genuine Young-Slitz type interference in these experiments. Okay, this is actually not the first experiment which historically claimed evidence for QIMDS. That distinction goes to the earlier work of Avshalom and co-workers. A good summary is given in this sort of semi-review article in 1995. And this was on magnetic biomolecules, and in particular on horse spleen ferritin. Now, you might ask, why the horse? And I think the answer is probably that at least when they started this series of experiments, the horse was much better at producing molecules which were at well-controlled molecular weight and so forth than any human chemist. So that's why they had to use horse spleen ferritin. But anyway, ferritin, more generally, is a complex biological molecule which has a so-called apoferritin sheath, which is magnetically inert and of no particular interest to us. And then it has a core, a magnetic core, which consists of something like 5,000 iron spins on atoms, And these spins are mostly antiferromagnetically aligned, but they do have a slight ferrimagnetic tendency. In other words, the two states I've indicated here do in fact have a net magnetic moment, although it's much smaller than the total number of spins here. So the question is, can I actually produce and verify a superposition of a couple of states in one of which the magnetic moment is net up and in the other of which it's net down? Well, assume that I could produce such a superposition. What kind of level splitting would that correspond to? In other words, presumably there would be a symmetric combination which will have one energy and an antisymmetric one which will have the opposite energy. You can actually try to calculate this. It turns out that the energy splitting is something, some kind of a temp frequency here, times an exponential factor, which is the exponent now is proportional to the number of spins, and then the other factors that come in are the uniaxial anisotropy due to the crystal structure and the isotropic exchange interaction. That's a sort of pretty standard formula in the theory of macroscopic magnetic behavior. Now, what the experimentalists actually did was to look at the linear response of the magnetic response of the system and the noise spectrum.
Yeah. Is there any external magnetic field?
Well, you can put one on. Yes, they do. In fact, it's control. It is a control parameter. Yep. Yeah. So then, of course, you would not expect the it to be symmetric. So. So basically, they found that above about 200 mK, both the chi and the noise spectrum were essentially featureless, but below, this had to be 200, I think, below 200 mK approximately, a sharp peak started to develop in both quantities at around 1 megahertz in the original experiment. And the evidence that they produced was that this was had something to do with this kind of macroscopic superposition was, first of all, the way in which the resonance frequency shifted with the magnetic field, which is indeed as one would expect. And secondly, the fact that when they did the they were able to adjust, and this is a later experiment, if I recall, they were able to adjust the number of spins and so measure the dependence of omega zero on n. It did indeed go, that omega did indeed go proportional to n, as you'd expect from this formula here. I have to say, though, that these data are rather controversial. There have been a number of critiques of the author's interpretation of them in the literature, and in particular, there have been claims in the literature that if you actually try to do any kind of decent microscopic calculation of what you'd expect this frequency to be, it's something like 14 orders of magnitude different from what's actually seen. So I think one has to say that's unresolved, really. One thing to notice about this experiment is that, rather obviously, I think, you never, well, rather obviously until at least in the last few years, you're not doing the experiment on a single ferritin molecule. You're doing an experiment on something like 10 to the 6 or 10 to the 7 ferritin molecules, and you're measuring the collective response. That means that this is in fact significant, because it means that this system at least is not going to be useful for the further tests, which I'll come to towards the end of this talk, which I would like to do. For these further tests, it turns out that it really is rather essential to have a single two-state system, which one can do a lot of experiments. Okay. The third system I want to talk briefly about, at least, is quantum optical systems. I should say I'm not going to attempt to get into the experimental details on this one. That is quite by itself quite a complicated subject. But let me just explain the general setup of the experiment. These experiments of Eugene Polzig's group over the last 10 years or so. Here's a review article on them. They actually had two clouds of cesium gas, each containing about 10 to the 12 atoms. And for such a system, it turns out that you have the standard computational relations of the components of angular momentum. And given this commutation relation, you can show that the product of the uncertainties in delta x, jx and jy, the x and y components of angular momentum, is bounded below by the expectation value of the z component. It's just basically the Heisenberg uncertainty relation applied to this particular set of operators. So the x component, the spread, the product of the spreads in x1 and angular momentum, jx for block 1 and jy for block 1 has got to be greater than or equal to that. Similarly for block 2. The same kind of relation applies to the total angular momentum of the sample. And so it has also this angular uncertainty relation for the total angular momentum of the two blocks together. So that means that if you can set up a situation such that jz1 is minus jz2, then and neither of these is zero identically, then these two uncertainty products must be greater than zero, but nevertheless, you may be able to get a zero spread for the product of the uncertainties of the combining angular momenta. This is basically the analogue, perhaps it's not immediately obvious, but it's essentially a macroscopic analogue of the EPR Bell situation. And in fact, it was really this was the motivation for the experiment. Fozick and company were in some sense interested in trying to push EPR Bell into the macroscopic domain rather than trying to push Schrödinger's cat into the microscopic domain, but nevertheless we'll see it does have some relevance here. Now, what does quantum theory say about such a situation? Well, obviously I'm leaving out a lot of the details here, but crudely speaking, the fact that this uncertainty product is of the order of n says by symmetry that the spread in jx1 itself has to be of the order of n to the half, at least. However, experiment tells us, and I won't say exactly how experiment tells us, as I say, that's quite a story in its own right. Experiment tells us that basically this uncertainty product is zero, so that means that the spread in the total jx must itself be essentially zero. So that now, what that tells you now is that delta jx1 must be exactly anti-correlated with delta jx2. So again, Einstein, Podolsky, Rosen-like. So that means the state is either a superposition or a mixture of a state in which gas 1 has x component of angular momentum n and gas 2 minus n, and so on. However, it can't be a mixture, because a mixture would not give you this result here, which is experimentally observed. Therefore, so if you interpret everything in straight quantum mechanical terms, that means that your statement has to be of this form, with appreciable weight for n of the order of, or less than, n to the half. Well, n to the half is something like 10 to the 6 here. So that means your disconnectivity, by a simple definition, is of the order of something like 10 to the 6. So I've skipped a lot of the details of this argument. A couple of things I want you to note. First of all, in order to get anything useful out of this experiment, one really, as far as I can see at least, has to interpret it in quantum mechanical terms. That is, you're using an awful lot of quantum mechanics in the not only in the interpretation of the raw data, but also in the implications which you can draw from it. Secondly, the disconnectivity. That is, crudely speaking, the number of particles which are behaving appreciably differently in the different branches of the superposition is of the order of n to the half, not of order n. And that does appear, as far as I can see, to be generic to this kind of experiment. So, as I say, this experiment was not done explicitly to look for the Schrödinger's cat-like aspect. It was done to look for the EPR Bell type aspect. But it does have some relevance, so I thought I'd mention it. However, the system I want to talk about in most detail is superconducting devices, and you will in fact be getting, I'll try to give you at least a brief introduction to this system, but Michel Devoret, who's coming next week, will be talking very specifically about this, so he'll fill you in on a lot of the experimental details and so forth, which I won't be able to mention.
And one thing I should just mention right at the start, and many of you probably will have had some contact with superconducting devices in their role as possible qubits in a quantum computer. That's certainly been a very serendipitous development, because it means that many experiments which probably would not have been funded without the advent of quantum computing have been able to piggyback on the quantum computing effort. That's probably true of most of the experiments I'm going to mention in this talk. However, I think one should emphasise that the aspects of superconducting devices which are of interest for quantum computing are not always of interest for QIMDS and vice versa. So there are lots and lots of papers in the literature, in particular non-experimental papers in the literature, on doing experiments on superconducting qubits with a view to their possible use as such. Not by any means all of these are particularly relevant to the foundations of quantum mechanics, at least not in the sense I've defined it. So we have to try to isolate those which are. Now, the advantages of superconducting devices are that, well, a number actually. There is a level of description of superconducting devices which is semi-classical, right, where you treat quantities like the flux and the circulating current, etc., as classical variables. And given that level of description, then I think one can say that the classical dynamics of these macroscopic variables is rather well understood. And there's been a lot of work on that over the last 40 years or so. Secondly, turns out, and this was not obvious ahead of time, but it turns out that the intrinsic dissipation is either naturally very low or at least can be made so by appropriate design. Another point is that the very well-developed classical technology based on the use of squids and many of the lessons we've learned in trying to develop that can be applied straightforwardly to the quantum behaviour. And I think most importantly, perhaps, is that you can get high, that in this kind of device, you can get a rather high level of disconnectivity without necessarily having to increase the classical action involved in the motion appreciably. And this then gets you around the objection which I think I mentioned in my last lecture, that if the action, as in the technical sense of classical mechanics, if the action becomes large in units of h-bar, then, by and large, you tend to lose your quantum effects. Well, luckily, it doesn't necessarily become large in the units of h bar for squids. Crudely speaking, this is an artist's theorist drawing, as it were. The typical system which is used in these experiments is a bulk superconductor, a superconducting ring, closed by a Josephson junction. And if you're not familiar with what a Josephson junction is, think of it as a sort of gate which will allow electrons, or more precisely pairs of electrons, through, but with increased difficulty. I'll give you a sort of five-minute breakdown of superconductivity theory. Let me just note before I do that in this case, the macroscopic variable we're talking about, the variable whose different states you'd like to superpose, is typically either the flux trapped through the ring, or what is essentially equivalent, the circulating current, I. Remember that the trapped flux here consists not only of an externally imposed part, but also a part due to the circulating currents themselves. So, crudely speaking, it's a one-one mapping from the trapped flux to the circulating current. Okay, well, that's the theorist's conception of an RF squid or flux qubit. Now let's have a look at the real experimentalist's version, and this is courtesy of my colleague, Dan Van Holingen, and here we have it. You see the scale on this is about 0.5 millimetres, but actually most of this diagram is somewhat irrelevant. All the action takes place in this little bit here, which is blown up below here. Okay, so if you ask about the physical scale, well, you can see, you could just about see that with the naked eye, with some difficulty perhaps, but you can just about see it. But however, it turns out that's not probably the most relevant question to ask. So let me now, I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with the next few minutes worth, but let me just go through it briefly for anyone who might not be. My next few couple of view graphs is a very basic rundown of superconductivity theory, very basic. So I would say, just those of you who know this already can go to sleep for the next few minutes. As you know, in elementary particles, we believe, come in two varieties, depending on whether they have integral or half-integral spin in units of h-bar. If they have integral spin, we call them bosons. If they have half-integral spin, we call them fermions. At low temperatures, fermions are really pretty boring. They tend to fill up the lowest energy states, the so-called Fermi C, up to a characteristic energy, the so-called Fermi energy. There's a small smearing of the order of the thermal energy, KT, around the Fermi energy. But basically, most of this stuff is completely inert and uninteresting. Bosons are much more interesting because they like to have a lot of particles in the same state, and they like it so much, in fact, that at sufficiently low temperatures, in three dimensions, you will get the phenomenon of so-called Bose condensation, in which a substantial fraction of all the particles in your system, all 10 to the 23 of them, prefer to go into a single one-particle state. And that's the phenomenon called Bose condensation, or Bose-Einstein condensation. Now, the electrons in metals, of course, have spin at half and therefore are fermions, so you might think they'd be very boring. However, it turns out that a compound object, which consists of an even number of fermions, has integral spin and therefore can be treated as a boson. So, for example, we always treat the helium-4 atom as a boson, and that's okay because it consists of two protons, two neutrons, and two electrons. So indeed, the helium-4 atom does obey Bose statistics. The helium-3 atom, by contrast, has two and one, and therefore an odd number of fermions that then behaves like a fermion itself. Anyway, it's well established that compound objects made of even numbers of fermions do behave like bosons, or can behave like that. Therefore, can undergo Bose condensation. And it's very, very crudely speaking, we believe that's what's happening when a metal goes superconducting. Now, you might think that, therefore, that the appropriate picture would be something like this, that two electrons would get together to form some kind of tightly bound complex. You might call it a dielectronic molecule. And that these objects would then undergo Bose condensation, just as if they were honest-to-goodness bosons. That might be right. It's entirely conceivable that is something like the right picture, for example, for the Cube Parade, high-temperature superconductors. However, this was certainly not the picture that was evolved for the old-fashioned superconductors by Dean Cooper and Schrieffer, my former Illinois colleagues, when they formulated what we now believe to be roughly the correct theory of old-fashioned superconductivity way back in 1957. What they postulated was something a bit different. Namely, you got two electrons forming a so-called Cooper pair, and this is somewhat like a diatomic molecule in the sense that the behavior of this electron here is strongly correlated with that of its partner over here. But you see they're very far apart, and in between them there are millions and millions of other electrons, each forming their own Cooper pairs. Yes, you have a question?
Yeah, yes. So why is that? What sets the scale?
What sets the scope? Yeah, very good question. It turns out that if you do the simplest possible kind of calculation, that is, you first of all, what's going to keep them together? Well, you have to, at least in the original BCS theory, you have to find some kind of effective attraction between the electrons, and this is believed to be exchange of virtual phonons, lattice vibrations. Just suppose that we have a short range, it will be short range, typically the order of angstrom, a short range interaction between two electrons. In three dimensions, in free space, this would not necessarily bind a pair. If the interaction is weak enough, it won't bind a pair. In two dimensions, it will bind a pair. And the reason for the difference, crudely speaking, is that the density of states at low energies is larger for two dimensions than it is for three dimensions. If three dimensions goes as epsilon to the half, in two dimensions it's constant. Now, what Cooper pointed out was that if you've already got a Fermi C there, then a lot of the states are blocked. So now you can only use, in some sense, this is Cooper's original calculation, you can only use the states which are available above the top of the Fermi C. But now the density of states is not zero. It's some kind of roughly constant value. And so it's like a two-dimensional situation. You will bind the pair. Okay, so the size of the pair and its binding energy is related to the strength of the interaction. The tricky point is that it's exponentially sensitive to the strength of the interaction. In fact, the standard BCS formula is that the radius of the pair is something like a typical atomic dimension, say an angstrom, multiplied by a factor exponential 1 over something involving the interactions. So that's extraordinarily sensitive to the size of the interaction. That's why, so typically, in an old-fashioned superconductor at least, the inter-electron spacing might be an angstrom or a couple of angstroms. This distance here, the radius of the pair, is much more like a micron. So it's huge. Now, the point I really want to stress in this slide is that in the simplest theory, the original BCS theory, an essential property of Cooper pairs, which is not at all obvious at first sight, is that once they are formed, they must automatically undergo Bose condensation. Doing anything else, trying to form Cooper pairs in a whole lot of different states at once, turns out to cost you a prohibitive amount of energy. So you've got to form them all in the same state. So they do in fact undergo a sort of Bose condensation. Like, that means that they must all do exactly the same thing at the same time. And that's even actually true in low-energy non-equilibrium situations, not just in an equilibrium situation. This, oddly enough, I always find it odd that very few of the standard textbooks on superconductivity theory emphasize this point, although in fact it's absolutely essential to the explanation of the macroscopic properties of superconductors. Okay, so let's now try to apply this idea. Let's imagine a simple superconducting ring in an external magnetic flux. For the moment, we don't have a Josephson junction in it. And so we have a quantization condition for a particle, charge 2e, in this case it's a Cooper pair. And that's pretty much the standard quantization condition. It's basically equivalent to the statement that angular momentum has to be quantized around this ring. It says that the circulation integral of the velocity, dot dl, is h over 2m times some integer n minus the flux in units of the flux quantum. Here, the flux quantum being h over 2e for Cooper pairs. So that's something which one can derive from rather fairly general principles of quantum mechanics. The energy associated with a given circulation is proportional to k squared. And since k has a sign, it clearly can't be proportional to k, and it, sure enough, it turns out to be proportional to k squared. Again, these two statements follow from really rather general considerations. Now, let's consider two cases. The first one is rather boring. Suppose that the externally applied flux is zero. Then you see you want to minimize the square. To get the ground state, you want to minimize the square of this quantity, but in that case, that's trivial, just n equals zero. So that says the ground state is unique. It just corresponds to all your pairs being at rest. Okay, no big deal. That's not particularly of interest to us. What about the case where the externally applied flux is exactly half of a flux quantum? Now, it turns out, the ground state is doubly degenerate because you see, if you put n equals 0 in here, you have a minus 5 of phi 0, and squaring that gives you 5 of phi 0 squared. If you have n equals 1, then you get plus 5 of phi 0, get the same value for the energy. Okay? So that says that you have two possible ground states, at least at this level of discussion. Either all your pairs must rotate anticlockwise, or they must all rotate clockwise. Now, of course, obvious question, why can't I have a state where half of my pairs are doing one thing and half the other, so as to get a nice, clean, symmetric ground state with angular momentum zero? And the answer is, it doesn't work, because, as I said, to allow Cooper pairs to occupy more than one of the possible states that allow them to behave differently from one another costs you an enormous amount of energy. Exactly why that is so is not at all a trivial question. It's something I've got a book published 3 or 4 years ago, Quantum Liquids, in which I actually spend a certain number of pages discussing this point because I think most textbooks don't discuss it, and it really is a rather important question. Anyway. So let's take that as read then, that all the Cooper pairs must do the same thing at the same time. Okay? So either this or this. And that would be the case for a simple
a simple uninterrupted ring. What happens now if we put a Joseph injunction in? Then life gets a lot more interesting. Now we find that, again, we can impose a trapped flux. Now, again, if we make that trapped flux equal to exactly half a flux quantum, we'll again, apparently, get the possibility of all your Cooper pairs circulating one way or all of them circulating the other. However, it now turns out, because of the specific properties of your Joseph's injunction, that there can now be tunneling processes between these two states. And since they you clearly have a certain degree of symmetry with respect to the clockwise and anticlockwise states, you might guess that the ground state for exactly half flux quantum would be say, the positive combination of these two states, this expression here, say, and then there'd be an excited state with a minus sign in here. And indeed, this is what quantum mechanics does turn out to predict. It predicts, in fact, that at exactly half flux quantum, you get this situation here. If you now vary away from the half flux quantum, you gradually return to a much more classical looking situation where basically you've got one state or the other. Okay? But at the crossing point here, at this crossing point, you do get a symmetric and antisymmetric combination. So that's a prediction of quantum mechanics. So is it possible to test that prediction experimentally? Yeah, the answer is yes. You can actually do a spectroscopic experiment to measure the frequency of radiation absorbed when you make the transition from the symmetric to the antisymmetric state, vice versa. And these experiments were first done at SUNY and Delft in 2000. And the prediction... Now, if you assume that you do not have a coherent quantum superposition of your two states, but you always had one state or the other, in other words, you always had a classical mixture, then the energy spectrum would be given by these pegged black lines here. And in particular, you'd find that exactly at the crossing, the resonance frequency was zero. If, on the other hand, you believe, according to elementary quantum mechanics, that you can superpose these two to get symmetric and anti-symmetric combinations, they correspond to the green curves here with a finite gap at crossing. And so the experiments were done by these two groups, and sure enough, it seems that the resonance frequencies actually correspond to the green lines rather than the black lines. So that's at least circumstantial evidence that you do get these superpositions occurring. In the last few years, a more spectacular set of experiments have been done. Real-time oscillations, that is, what you crudely speaking, what you do is you start the system in definite one of these two states, go away and refuse to watch it, come back a few minutes later and watch where it's got to. Well, not because exactly what you do, but it's something like that. You do a Ramsey fringe experiment. Now, I'm going to show you a picture, this is just to convince you that experimental data are for real. I mean, they're there in the literature and so forth. I'm not making this up. But it's important to realise what you're seeing here. This is from the Delft group, I guess, in a 2003 experiment. What I want to emphasise is that you are not here seeing these wobbles don't correspond to the system going backwards and forwards. The time scale of that is much faster than this. This is a typical Ramsey fringe trace, improved somewhat here with spin echo techniques. If you actually go try to analyse this data in terms of the actual Q factor of the oscillations. Remember that the system is just going backwards and forwards coherently, or trying to, rather like an ammonia molecule. Okay? If you ask what is the Q factor of these oscillations, the result is quite surprising. I think had someone told me in 1999 that by the year 2010 people were going to be doing this kind of experiments with squids and looking for these coherent oscillations and asked me to predict what kind of Q factor they would get, I'd say you're going to be very lucky to get two or three. Well, they get 500 these days. So this really is a rather spectacular example of a coherent quantum behaviour at a level. We'll see exactly what the level is in a moment, but it's at a level which a lot of people thought would never happen, as it were.
Okay. Well, as I say, yeah. Yeah. Yep.
What is the superconducting ring?
Yep.
And then we have moving charges.
That's right.
Yes. So those moving charges are going to set up an induced magnetic dipole.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
But now, if you have these currents in a superposition,
yes.
You have this magnetic moment
that's
in a superposition.
That's right. Yes.
And that seems like a very weird thing. Because mm-hmm. then if you were to fire an electron,
yep. That's right. Yes.
Then
oh, absolutely. Absolutely, yes. That's right. Yes, in fact, you see, one of the things that at first sight is worrying about this whole business is that, at least at first sight, it seems that if there was just some stray electron passing by, so that it comes in from, let's say, a given angle, it's going to be diverted differently according to whether the magnetic flux is up and down. And if you then catch that electron on a photographic plate, say, then you've made a which-way measurement. So the superposition should not survive. Okay? And in fact, it was this kind of argument that made people so sceptical originally about the whole proposal. The answer is you've just got to... you know, just got to do the nitty-gritty of figuring out what the possible perturbations in real life are. I mean, it's a bit like, you know, a doctor faced with the statement that a particular disease is always fatal. Okay? A sensible doctor faced by that question asks himself, okay, why is this disease fatal? What exactly is it doing to kill you? Maybe it's obstructing your windpipe, maybe it's decaying your brain, whatever, but... You know, once he's decided that, then there are usually ways he can go in and correct for that. So in the case of these squids, originally people said, oh, look, this is complete nonsense. You've got the normal electrons, you've got the black body radiation field, you've got the nuclear spins. You have all sorts of junk that's going to be sensitive to which way these currents are flowing. Well, you just have to work out how sensitive it is, and it turns out most of these things are really not that important. In particular, you see, the worst, the most obvious and most dangerous contribution almost certainly is the normal electrons. But now I'm going to ask the following question. I take a 1 centimetre cube of niobium, okay, a typical old-fashioned superconductor. Niobium has a transition temperature of around 9 degrees. I take that 1 centimetre block of niobium down to, let's say, 5-10 millik, something I reasonably routinely do these days. Right? And I ask you, not what is the fraction of normal electrons, but what is the number of normal electrons in that 1 centimetre cube? Anyone know the answer? Zero. Well, 10 to the minus dot, 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 actually. It's basically exponential minus Tc over t, and that exponential is a very, very small number.
This is your reason for emphasizing earlier that they all have to behave the same way.
Well, yeah, I mean, that, it's connected, yes. I mean, the fact that, of course, you only get no normal electrons because they've all been absorbed into the cube of pairs, yes. Uh-huh. But nevertheless, I mean, if I were at some somewhat higher temperatures, over 100 millik, then almost certainly these experiments would not work because I would have enough electrons which are not absorbed into the cube of pairs. But... what is it like here? Yep.
Those experimental data was for a sample of systems which are prepared in exactly the same state, and then you, at different times you look at those.
Yeah, crudely speaking, you have one pulse which you start with the system in its ground state. You have a pi over 2 pulse which excites it into a linear superposition of the ground and excited states. Then you sort of shut it off, go away, and come back.
So superposition of clockwise and anti-clockwise?
Well, actually, it's a little more complicated than that, because remember that the energy eigens, if I'm exactly at, heart, say, at the crossing point, then my actual energy eigenstates are not clockwise or anti-clockwise, but rather the symmetric and anti-symmetric combinations of clockwise and anti-clockwise.
And is it to check that whether you have, for example, clockwise plus anti-clockwise or clockwise minus anti-clockwise? Controlling that phase or defining that phase,
Well, okay, I think there are two separate questions there. First of all, is it meaningful to try and define the phase, or is it just a random convention? And I think the answer is that with any sort of reasonable definition of your...
Yeah, but to see that oscillation, you need to make sure that all of them have the same phase. All of them are...
well, right.
Plus or, so you have to define the phase for...
Yeah. Okay, I mean, I think to some extent, I have better answer your question towards the end of this talk, but when I'll be actually asking, as it were, what can one deduce from this kind of experiment independently of quantum mechanical considerations. I'm assuming that we assume that in some sense quantum mechanics is basically working here, but we're not sure whether we're seeing a superposition or a mixture. And the point is that if you had a mixture, if at an intermediate time you had a mixture, it would not then evolve into these coherent oscillations. Okay, so now this comes to a very important question. Yeah, sure.
How many electrons are actually participating in the superposition of current? Because only the Fermi sphere only shifts.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. I'll just come to that point. Right. Yes. This is precisely my next turn. Okay, so what is the disconnectivity, or if you like, the Schrödinger's cattiness of the states observed in the squibs in the QIMDS experiment, more generally in the experiments? Well, crudely speaking, as I say, the definition of disconnectivity is a matter of convention to some extent. But crudely speaking, it's the number of particles which are behaving differently, appreciably differently in the two branches of the superposition. Now, in some cases, this is rather straightforward to make an estimate of that. For example, in the Fullerene diffraction experiments, it's simply the number of elementary particles in a C60 molecule. Now, by elementary, as I said last time, I'm not interested in quarks and gluons and so forth. I mean good old-fashioned electrons, neutrons, protons. Okay, so that's about 1,200. For the magnetic biomolecules, similarly, the number of spins which have to reverse to get you from one branch to the other is something like 5,000. For the other cases, it really is, you really have to be a little more careful about the precise definition. Let me just talk about the squid experiments, because those are the ones that have been most discussed. In a naive approach, you use the language that I did previously. You say, okay, in one state you had all your Cooper pairs circulating one way, in the other state they're circulating the other way. Now, that already brings in a complication, because in fact it turns out that in this kind of geometry, the current is not carried uniformly in the bulk of the ring, it's carried in the penetration depth next to the surface. So that knocks down your factor already. But if you do make that definition, then you find that the disconnectivity is the order of the total number of Cooper pairs involved in carrying the current. So it's of the order of 10 to the 9, 10 to the 10th. However, there is a snake there. It's been pointed out by a number of people, in particular by Korsbach and et al. In a recent paper, that the fact that you're actually talking about indistinguishable objects, which obey Fermi statistics, means that although the currents in the two states are rather different, I mean, typically microamps either way, the number of single electrons which you have to displace in momentum space to get from one to the other is actually rather small. And in fact, they actually work out a figure which actually turns out, I don't think they commented this explicitly, but the disconnectivity estimated in this way is of the order of the total number of particles, but multiplied by this rather small factor. Vs is the velocity of the circulating electrons, the central mass velocity, Vf is the Fermi velocity, and that comes out to knock that number down quite considerably, 10 to the 3, 10 to the 4. Now, for various reasons, I don't believe that's necessarily I can't say reasonable or unreasonable, because often I was talking about a matter of definition, but I think it's a slightly unnatural definition. As one can see, if one imagines that one goes over, as one can now continuously, in fact, in Fermi alkali gases, by tweaking the interaction, you can go over continuously from a situation in which you've got Cooper pairs formed, that is extreme degenerate Fermi gas with Cooper pairs, go over to the case where you really do get tightly bound diatomic molecules. In other words, you go back from, let's just show that briefly, you go back from this situation, believed to describe classic superconductors, to this situation, which would be real dielectronic molecules. And in the dielectronic molecule limit, it seems, I think, fairly plausible that your disconnectivity really is of the order of the number of bosons. So for that reason, and other more technical ones I don't have time to go into, I don't personally particularly favour this conclusion. Rather, I think I would settle for something in between these two. One thing you can always define for any situation where you've got either straight Bose condensation of fermion pairs or Cooper pairing is the macroscopic eigenvalue of the two particle density matrix. Crudely speaking, it's the number of Cooper pairs, very crudely. And then it turns out you get a number which is this order of magnitude, so it's not as large as n, but it's not as small as this. Typically, it's the order of 10 to the 6 or 10 to the 7. Yep.
Following up on Adam's point, can you talk about the net action difference between the angular dipole moments created by...
I think the only action you could reasonably talk about would be that involved in the tunneling between the two. So that is, you can ask, you can express the tunneling, the matrix element for tunneling between these two states as... in the form of some prefactor times exponential minus S over H bar, where S is the action corresponding to going under the barrier, as it were.
Sorry, maybe I'm missing something, but I can imagine, I mean, if it's a dipole moment, we can talk about it as an angular momentum, and therefore it has some...
Oh, well, no, if you do that, then it's large. The figure I can quote to you, I've worked this out, I think everyone agrees on this, is the magnetic moment of equivalent the angular momentum in microscopic units, and in microscopic units means H bar in this case.
Yeah.
The answer is about 10 to the 9 or 10 to the 10.
Is the difference? Well, it's factor
yeah.
2, so it's
yeah.
the same.
Yeah, yeah,
so
that's
10
right.
to the 9.
Yeah,
that's
something like
that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so from that point of view, I think one feels fairly satisfied in calling these states macroscopically distinct. But you still have to ask the question: okay, how many particles did I, how many states did I actually have to change to get from one to the other? Well, very briefly, let me think. Yeah, let me just very briefly skim through the where we are, as it were. So using my rather crude figures of merit, as it were, let's just review briefly where we've got to. A single electron has a trivial extensive difference 1 and disconnectivity 1, nothing at all interesting. A neutron interferometer has a very large value of this quantity, because the displacement of the two beams in typical atomic units can be 10 to the 9, but you're only talking about one particle, really. So that's still has a 1 here. Some beautiful experiments by Arroche's group in Paris on QED cavities. There, both these figures are something of the order of 10. That's still very, very, very neat experiments, very impressive. But not really, I think one wouldn't really call this macroscopic. In a Cooper pair box, one of the systems which people have discussed, again, the extensive difference is quite large, but again, you're only talking about the motion of a single Cooper pair. I guess I discussed that point very briefly last time. For the Fullerene experiments, both these numbers, about 1,000. For ferritin, about 5,000, if you interpret them according to the author's view. The quantum optics experiments, about 10 to the 6. But I think the Guinness Book of Records is held, really, by the script date. This figure is certainly... The extensive difference is certainly of the order of 10 to the 9 to 10 to the 10. This one, well, that's more controversial. Could be anything from 10 to the 4 up to 10 to the 10. You have to decide which definition you like, really. But just for comparison, let's see how we're doing compared to what all of us would agree are honest-to-goodness macroscopic objects. For the smallest dust particle, this figure is about 10 to the 9, 19, sorry. This figure, surprisingly, can actually be quite small. I could come back to that point if I was interested. It's a rather subtle point involved there. For the cat, typically 10 to the 34 in this column, 10 to the 25 in this column. So where are we? You all know that if you want to massage your data and make it look better than it really is, you plot it on a logarithmic scale. So let's ask, on a logarithmic scale, how far are we on the road from the atom to our own subjective consciousness? Answer, maybe 40 to 50%, something like that, which might not seem too bad. Okay, I think I'll skip... other possibilities for QIMDS, although there's some very interesting stuff here. Let me very briefly go through this view graph. Do I want to do that? No. Okay, I'll just make the verbal comment that so far the data do appear to be consistent with the hypothesis that quantum mechanics is still working at the level of squibs and similar things. They do not, however, exclude either macro-realistic theories as a whole or specific kinds of macro-realistic theory. The reason for that is actually slightly technical. You might think that squid experiments, for example, ought to be able to exclude the GRWP theory of reduction. Unfortunately not, it turns out, because GRWP has this special feature that the reduction of a superposition to one of its branches is triggered only when you get a large separation of the centre of mass in the two branches. Now, unfortunately, in the squid case, the only difference between these two states really is the circulating current. So there's no displacement of the centre of mass between the two. With one of my students, I've been trying to figure out how one might be able to pretty up these squid experiments so that you do get a displacement of the centre of mass. For example, you might hang a little magnet above the squid or whatever. Turns out that's pretty difficult, actually, so I suspect it's not something that's going to be done in short order. But right now we've seen that apparently everything is consistent with quantum mechanics working, but we have not been able yet to refute alternative hypotheses. Okay, so where do we go from here? The most obvious direction is simply to try to work towards larger values of these two parameters, but I don't actually think that's terribly interesting in its own right. I mean, now that we've seen that, to say 10 to the 9 or 10 to the 10 electrons behave according to the postulates of quantum mechanics in a particular situation, it doesn't seem that interesting to verify that 10 to the 12 or 10 to the 13 do. Rather, I think one should probably, as it were, try to go along different axes here. One way would be to try to superpose states of different biological functionality, getting a lot closer to our own consciousness, like. For example, this is a suggestion which a number of people have made. It's usually believed that the first stage of the human visual process is that a bunch of photons comes into your eye, strikes the retina, and triggers a conformational transition in a single rhodopsin molecule. How many photons do you need? Well, it's sort of statistical matter, but typically the order of half a dozen. Now, by now, there really are there are experiments where people have created, I think I'm correct in saying, maybe people know better, but there have been reports of creation of N equals 6 GHZ states. In fact, I believe even N equals 8 GHZ states. So you can get, it is possible to produce a superposition of a vacuum and a 6-photon state. Okay, imagine you shine this on the human eye. Okay? If you believe quantum mechanics, then, very crudely, what you'd expect is that you produce a superposition of the state of the rhodopsin molecule, which is triggered, and one which is untriggered. Now, of course, it would be very, very nice indeed if we could actually not only produce that state, but verify that it really is a superposition, not a mixture of those two states. That would be a lot closer to our own subjective consciousness. Alas, at this point, the biologists always come in clamouring and saying, what you have forgotten is that biological systems, by their very nature, are warm and wet. And warm and wet, when translated from the language of biology into that of physics, is highly decoherent, very, very highly decoherent. So it seems to be unlikely that this is an experiment which is going to be done in the next 20 or 30 years. Maybe in 100 years it might be possible. Remember, one of the things you always have to remember in this whole game is if you look back on the history of this whole subject, people who've tried to estimate the degree of decoherence in these various systems have almost inevitably, almost without exception, overestimated it. So many of these systems are much less decoherent than had been expected. So I think it's not entirely impossible that in 50 or 100 years' time people will be doing these experiments on the human eye. We'll see. Another possibility would look for more sophisticated forms of entanglement. A very interesting paper by Scott Aronson, where he specifically asked the question, okay, given that certain types of macroscopic superposition, etc., appear to have been, we can't say they've been confirmed exactly, but they appear to be consistent with the experimental data present, are there more subtle forms of wave function which might in some sense induce a breakdown of standard quantum mechanics? And he's tried to identify a class of states which would. Again, very difficult, I think, in practice to look for those states, but it might be worth a try. However, I think the most obvious, yeah, I'm going to have to really speed up, I'm afraid, most obvious extension of these experiments, and one I think which will certainly be done over the next 5 or 10 years, is to exclude macro realism. Okay, what do I mean by that? We've said the experiments, let's just talk about a particular level, namely the level of squids, 10 to the 9, 10 to the 10 electrons. What existing experiments have showed is that everything is consistent with quantum mechanics still working. However, it's a basic theorem of the logic of science, no finite number of experiments could ever prove quantum mechanics to be correct. It's just a theorem, basically. However, you do have a plausible competing class of theories, namely macrorealism, which, remember, macrorealism is a class of theories in which a macroscopic body is always in a definite macroscopic state, not in a quantum superposition. That, it might be possible, rather than proving quantum mechanics to be right, to prove that this class of theories is wrong. Nothing, no theorem in the logic of science says that a finite number of experiments cannot disprove a theory. Okay? I've shown it to be false. So let's try that. We have to be a little more specific. Imagine our squid ring, and we know that whenever we observe, and this is an experiment which has been done, quite some years ago, whenever we observe this system to see whether the current is clockwise or anticlockwise, it's always one or the other. So let's assign a value q equals plus 1 to clockwise, or q equals minus 1 to anticlockwise. Let's define a macro-realistic theory by three postulates. First of all, q of t is plus or minus 1 at all times, whether or not you're actually observing it. I say almost all because you do have to allow transit times, but you can do that. That's a minor detail. Secondly, non-invasive measurability. In principle, at least, it's possible to do an experiment to measure q of t in a way which does not disturb the system or its subsequent behaviour. Again, I can go into that if anyone's interested. Finally, induction. The properties of physical ensembles are determined only by their initial preparation, not by what's going to happen to them later on, as it were. Okay. Given that, it turns out, you can actually do a test. Now, those of you who are, most of you I see, are familiar with Bell's theorem, so you'll probably recognise this as the general structure of this formula. We define a quantity k, which is a function of four observation times. The sum of three correlations plus the difference, with a fourth one. Okay. These are experimentally measurable quantities. If you take this particular value of the times involved, then it turns out that any macro-realistic theory will predict that k is less than or equal to 2. And very similar to the CHS8 theorem in Bell's context. I think that's generally agreed. Not much doubt about that. If you treat the system, the squid system, say, as an ideal two-state system, then, again, similarly to Bell and CHS8, quantum mechanics predicts that k is 2.8, which clearly is not less than or equal to 2. If you now try to do a real calculation with all the real-life complications and apply quantum mechanics to it, then, okay, that becomes a lot more tricky, but there have been quite a few such calculations over the last few years, and I think there's fairly a substantial degree of agreement that under reasonably realistic experimental conditions, you can actually get a quantum mechanical prediction that k is not as big as 2.8, but certainly bigger than 2. Okay? Therefore, to the extent that the analysis of KC within quantum mechanics is reliable, you can force nature to choose between macro-realism and quantum mechanics. It can't have it both ways. If it comes out consistently with quantum mechanics, it's got to show that macro-realism is false, at least at this level. Possible outcomes of this experiment. Outcome number one, there's too much noise, just things you hadn't anticipated, whatever, F noise, etc. The quantum mechanical prediction is less than 2 and therefore no longer in contradiction with this. I think the experimenters pretty soon get around that one and reduce the noise sources to the point where that was not the case. So then the possibilities are, first of all, that k is greater than 2, comes out to be greater than 2, and whatever that says about quantum mechanics, it certainly says, apparently, that macro-realism is refuted. Okay, how spectacular is that? Well, that's for you to judge. As I say, we're maybe 40 to 50% along on a logarithmic scale from the atom to a real-life can. So whether you think it's significant or not, I mean, up to you. Final possibility, k is less than 2. Ow,
then of course the roof falls in on the whole thing, and we have at that point fight all sorts of objections about the actual setup of the experiment, and even more about the theory which we applied to the experiment. Are we sure that our quantum mechanical calculations are right? No, we're not. But however, many of, and let me emphasise again what something I emphasised in my last lecture, that I think the general feeling, which I think certainly people coming from other fields of physics tend to have when they first look at this, the general feeling that no condensed matter system can ever be a legitimate test of basic properties of quantum mechanics, I think that is overblown. I mean, I think we've got certainly not total control, we've got a lot more control than is generally realised over the behaviour of many body systems. And as I say, we don't do that by starting from an a priori Hamiltonian, we do it by looking at the classical behaviour first and then trying to input that into the quantum behaviour. So I think, obviously there are lots of loopholes left, they would have been blocked. If we assume they are blocked, then do come out with something rather spectacular. That would lead us, I think, rather seriously to consider the possibility that the mere fact that quantum mechanics brilliantly describes electrons and atoms, and macroscopic bodies, so we believe, are made out of electrons and atoms, that does not logically imply that quantum mechanics brilliantly describes macroscopic objects. Could be something else coming in. That would be very, very exciting. I don't know what the possibilities of it happening are. Certainly, I suspect the possibilities of it happening in my lifetime are rather thin. Possibilities of it happening in your lifetimes, maybe a little bit, but maybe not that high. Anyway, I think this has led to a lot of useful spin-off. So, like many such things, it's even if it doesn't turn out to fulfil the original goal, lots of interesting things have been thrown up along the way. I'm afraid I'm going to have to take off, so feel free to, if you have questions, would like to send an email message, I'll try to answer them.